Well, good evening once again, everyone. I got some interesting comments and emails this week from people who were concerned that I had gone post-trib. And I thought, well, okay, that means I made a convincing argument, or at least a threatening one. I guess it depends on how you view it. We're talking about the rapture of the church, and as we look into some of the passages, I'd like you to begin again, as we did last week, with John chapter 14, if you would please, where we have the personal reminder from the Lord, and this is a key passage on the subject of the rapture that is often not the one that people turn to. And I hope that during the week some of you came up with some questions, because this is an open Q&A on the subject of the rapture. And as we start working our way through, what I'm going to do is review a little bit from last week, so we'll get up to speed, and then we'll move into the material for this evening. But in John chapter 14, Jesus says to his men, "Let not your heart be troubled. Believe in God and believe in me." Stop letting your heart be troubled. In my Father's house are many dwelling places. If it were not so, I would have told you, and I'm going to go prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. Look how relational this is. Remember, we closed last time by focusing on the fact that the Lord wants to see you in his presence more than you want to actually be there. And then you might be a person who right now is thinking to themselves, that's impossible. I want to be in the Lord's presence more than anything else in my life. But he's actually capable of wanting you more than you want him by virtue of the fact that he's infinite and you're not. When my kids and my grandkids sometimes say, well, I love you, and I tell them, not as much as I love you, and they say, oh, yes, you know, we have this little back and forth, you know, and I say, oh, yes, sir, and I love you more. No, I love you more. No, I love you more. No. And I said, what do you do? And then that kind of a thing, what do? You pull rank. I'm bigger than you. I love you more. Okay? I'm just capable of loving you more, and I know more about you than you know about me. And I still love you, which means I love you more than you love me, because you love only that which you know about me, which in all honesty isn't very much. But I know all about you. I've known you since before you were conceived. I gave you life. I can take you out. No, that's discipline. We know our kids and we love them no matter what. That is exactly what Jesus is saying to his men here. And I want us to reconnect with the relationality of that, with the fact that when we talk about these things, the rapture and so on, we're not just talking about doctrines, things we have to sign off on, you know, in order to be in certain fellowships or whatever. And this better not be one you have to sign off on in order to be in any church anyway, but we'll get to that part. We are talking about a deep and profound love that the Lord has for us. And that's why he says, don't let your heart be troubled. He's saying the same thing to his people and to all of us. No matter what, I know it seems like your heart ought to be troubled, and I know that there's a lot to trouble your heart in this age, and I know that we're not as big and as smart as he is, but he says, you simply have got to trust me. Don't let your heart be troubled. I want to be with you more than you want to be with me, which means if I'm leaving you here, it's for a perfectly good reason. In fact, a better reason than you can possibly imagine. He says, you know the way where I'm going. And of course, we saw this last week. Thomas says, no, we don't. Jesus says, yes, you do. Why? Because you know me, and that's all you need to know. I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father but through me. Now, when we move from here and we look into the way that the gospel was preached in the first century, what we find is that this promise that he would come and get us is actually part of the message of the cross. At the heart and soul of everything that the gospel is the work of Jesus on the cross. But there's also this future promise, this hope that he will come and get us, and that we actually have a membership with him in his kingdom. And so as we move through, if you've got your notes from last week or you picked up a new set, they were identical this evening. What we saw in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 was that when he comes to get us, two things will take place. You remember what they were. One is that we would be caught up to be with him, 1 Thessalonians 4, verses 13 all the way into 5:11, but that chapter 5 part is about the second coming. It's about the Lord's return to judge the earth. But then there's this earlier part at the end of chapter 4, 1 Thessalonians, where it says we will be caught up to be with him. And this is where the term rapture comes from, if you remember correctly, from the Latin. And so there's this sense in which we look forward to literally being caught up to be with him. It's a one-time event. It's not duplicated anywhere else, and there's no way to practice it. Though if we could, we would, I know. We'd jump, you know. And then the second thing that takes place is in 1 Corinthians 15, 50 to 58, which we also looked at last week, in which there is a complete change, and what will eventually be the permanent life that you will live, you simply enter into. Whatever generation is alive at the time will simply be altered immediately and brought into that the state that the Apostle Paul refers to in 1 Corinthians 15, which is a spirit material body. A spirit material body. There is materiality in the spirit realm. It's just not the same kind of materiality that we have, and so we don't have a vocabulary for it. But the spirit realm has a real tangible, that's what Paul's whole point in 1 Corinthians 15 is that there's all different kinds of glory and different types of bodies, and they vary even in this creation. He makes this illustration, 1 Corinthians 15. And he says, what's true here is also true in the spirit realm. You have a very real body. And so what happens is, at the time of what we call the rapture, when the Lord comes, he literally snatches us away, we meet him in the air, and we are completely transformed and given resurrection bodies. And even before that takes place, we saw in 1 Thessalonians 4, even before that takes place, the dead in Christ will receive their bodies, okay? So what happens is, a person who dies now, goes to be with a Christian, goes to be with the Lord, is there tangibly and really, we don't know in what, you know, we don't know what they look like, but they're real, and they're there, and they're conscious, and they're aware. And what happens at the rapture then is that person receives a resurrected body that is made of the same material that the spirit realm is made of. So that there is a complete transformation for everybody who's living and a complete transformation for everybody who's already died. Okay, so far so good. Any questions on that so far? Okay, are you all looking forward to that? Yeah, that's right. Okay, so then we got into some of the things that we agree on. All serious Christians agree that the Lord will return for us. And that's true. If a person doesn't have in their mind and heart the idea of the second coming, where the Lord comes back, their consciousness of the gospel, their awareness of the gospel is terribly deficient. The second coming is part and parcel of the gospel message. So this is not a question of date. The question is when. But it's not a question of date. Chronological relationship of the final events is what we disagree on as Christians. And the passages that discuss these things are not sufficiently clear in themselves to answer our chronological questions. And so that's why we sit back and we debate over it and we have these different views. A lot of this has to do with what is known as a period of time called the tribulation period. And this tribulation period is a reference, and we're going to, I hope, take some questions on this. It's a reference to probably Daniel's 70th week. Now, I want you to turn there, because we didn't last week. I want you to turn to Daniel chapter 9. Daniel 9. Beginning in verse 24 of Daniel 9, we're going to go down through verse 27, but the 70th week of Daniel is located in verse 27. It's part of a prophecy that was, or part of a vision that was given to Daniel and became a prophecy. And it is often, that last 70th week is often discussed as what we call the tribulation or the great tribulation. And both terms are used of the same period of time. It depends on who you're talking to. Now, Daniel's been praying. By the time we look at this, this is in the 6th century BC. It's towards the end, at the very end of the Babylonian captivity. Daniel, who's Jewish, of course, is praying and asking the Lord what's going to happen to the Jewish people. That's very, very important because the theme of this question and answer that is given in this particular vision, the theme is Israel. And that becomes important when we start talking about the timing of the rapture, as we're going to see. If you don't see that what he's talking about is something to do with Israel's history, then you're going to be interpreting the rapture in a slightly different way. And this will become important in a moment. Look at verse 24, Daniel chapter 9. 70 weeks, now these refer to basically periods of seven is all it says, 77s, but it's pretty obvious that they're years. 70 weeks have been decreed for your people and your holy city, see Israel and Jerusalem, to finish the transgression, to make an end of sin, to make atonement for iniquity, and to bring in everlasting righteousness. To seal up vision and prophecy and to anoint the most holy place. Now, when you look at this, does this appear to be pretty much going to be the end of the story by the time this is done? Look at the list of things that takes place. Daniel says, what's going to happen to Israel? The angel says 70 periods of seven, probably years, in fact, almost certainly years. And by the time the prophecy is finished, everything will be accomplished. Finish the transgression, make an end of sin, make atonement for iniquity, bring in everlasting righteousness, seal up vision and prophecy, and anoint the most holy place. That's amazing. That's a lot to do. That's really pretty much God taking his kingdom back, his whole world back, and bringing his kingdom to the earth. So he says, you are to know and discern that from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. It will be built again with plaza and moat, even in times of distress. Now, I'm not going to do more on this. We're just going to kind of move through it. But he's talking about how many years it would be until Messiah. And if you add it all up, it comes to 483 years, which no matter where you date the order to restore and rebuild Jerusalem under Artaxerxes in that era, it, when you add up the years, it comes out to right in the ministry of Jesus Christ, which is just too much of a coincidence for it to be anything but to be taken literally. So when people look at this and they say, well, I'm not sure we should take it all literally. If you take it literally and it makes perfect sense when you take it literally, you should, okay? And so these are years, no doubt, as a result of this. After the 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing, and the people of the prince who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. The prince who is to come, in all probability, the Antichrist. And its end will come with a flood. Even to the end, there will be war. Desolations are determined. And he, meaning the prince who is to come, will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week. Now, this is the 70th week of Daniel, okay? For one period of seven, he will make a firm covenant with the many, probably the covenant community of Israel. Because why? Why do we say the firm covenant with the many in that context? Because the context of the passage is Israel. Daniel wasn't asking, what are you going to do with Nebuchadnezzar? What are you going to do with the Gentiles? He was saying, what are you going to do with Israel? I'm concerned for Israel. But in the middle of the week, in the middle of that period of time, he will put a stop to sacrifice and grain offerings. So you have the first half of this period of time is a period of time in which there appears to be some safety and apparently the Antichrist. And I know I'm leaping ahead and not answering all the questions here, but you can ask them if you want, if I'm going too fast. But apparently for the first half of this 7-year period, for 3.5 years, there's some sense in which things seem to be going okay. And then in the middle of that period of time, he changes his tune and breaks his pact with God's people and puts a stop to sacrifice and grain offering. And on the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate. This is what Jesus said when he said, when you see the abomination of desolation in the holy place, that's a sign that something's, that it's all coming down. Until a complete destruction, one that is decreed, is poured out on the one who makes desolate. Now, you see that last 7 years, in our discussions, when you hear people talking about post-trib, pre-trib, and so on, The context of that last 7 years is the crucial issue. In fact, it is in the context of whether you call that the tribulation, and if it's really God's wrath being poured out, that all the titles of the various positions on the rapture get their names. Pre-trib, mid-trib, post-trib. Why? Well, that seven-year period, if it is the tribulation, and this is where sometimes the people who debate these things are saying, maybe it's not. Maybe the tribulation is a longer period, and this is just the last 7 years of it. So you get into these discussions. But normally, among the folks that you'll talk to, this is the thing they're talking about, this last 7 years. And they normally call it the tribulation. And they sometimes call it the great tribulation. Okay, back to your notes. Any questions on that? That is a great question. Lee's question is, why could we not see this as having been fulfilled in the destruction of Jerusalem by Titus? And there's a whole school of thought that actually does believe that. The consequence is that they're not looking for a future tribulation. They're living as though they are in the tribulation right now, or they're living in a time of increasing distress. But they would say this was all fulfilled back then. And the main reason is because when you read Matthew 24 and Jesus quotes this, there's so many things that didn't seem to happen. Some did, but not everything, not enough. In the Olivet Discourse, it describes the Lord's actual second coming at the end of that, and he didn't come at the end of that when Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 AD. So my view on that is there's a partial fulfillment in 70 AD, but as with so many prophecies, there's this partial fulfillment, a double fulfillment, so the smaller one in the beginning and then the ultimate one at the end, where all of everything is fulfilled. There were just not enough of it was completed at the time. And Jesus actually pointed forward to an abomination of desolation in the temple, and it's very, very hard to attach anything that happened with Titus when he destroyed the temple. He did destroy the temple, but that doesn't seem to be what's going on here with regard to the abomination of desolation in the temple area. There seems to be something else. And if you equate this with Antiochus Epiphanes, which is later in the book of Daniel, there's a partial fulfillment there too. There really is, in my opinion. But that's much clearer. I mean, he actually slaughters a pig on the altar in Jerusalem, and he becomes sort of the precursor to the ultimate evil. You know, that didn't take place in 70 AD. So, but it's a great question. And there are people who think that it did take place completely back then. Another question? What Chuck is pointing out is that if we put 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 together with what Jesus says and some of these prophecies, what we find is that the man of lawlessness, the Antichrist, sets himself up as God, and he becomes the abomination. Is that what you're talking about? That he sort of is the abomination of desolation, setting himself up as God in the temple? Yes. But there again, I mean, the point is still valid here that we were making, and that is that that didn't happen in 70 AD. But you're right. The Antichrist does something worse than Antiochus Epiphanes did. Even though Antiochus Epiphanes did consider himself a god, and many of the Roman emperors did too, but the future one is going to do something worldwide that apparently is much more dramatic, much more blasphemous even than what Antiochus did. Oh, the rebuilt temple. Yeah, will there be a rebuilt temple? I think that it's quite possible that there will be, and a lot of the prophecies talk about it. The people who don't hold that would say that it is a form of worship that is like the temple is today. What's the temple today? Us. That's right. The temple today is us. And so people who don't believe in a rebuilt temple would say that same us concept would be the center of worship during that period of time that is somehow inverted and becomes idolatrous. So in both, whether you believe in a literal temple being rebuilt or whether you believe in a spiritual temple, which we know what exists, there's a spiritual temple, it's us when we gather in the name of Jesus. Either way, whatever happens here is a desecration of that, okay? So my personal view is I see no problem with them rebuilding a temple there. I know that there's, most of you know that there's a group of people that are putting the stuff together to do that. It would be a good way to start Armageddon. Build a temple on the Temple Mount to Yahweh because it's the third holiest site in Islam. And so that would cause a war for sure. And so, you know, there could be a physical temple there. Well, I think if there's a temple, they're going to offer animal sacrifices. There's no reason to build a temple and not reinstitute the priesthood because this is not a temple being built by Christians in memoriam. you know, building the temple because, you know, to just because we appreciated, you know, our history. These would be Jewish people who are going to try and restart the sacrificial system. Again, I don't see any problem with that. I think that they could try to do that at that period of time. And Judaism doesn't work without the temple. Does everybody understand that? I mean, it works in the sense that if you talk to Jewish people today, they'll find they have worked out over a long time ways of saying, no, Judaism still functions even though we don't make sacrifices in the temple. However, if you compare that with the scriptures, not having the temple is a major problem. Judaism functions with a temple and a priesthood because in order to deal with guilt and sin, that has to happen. So I would say that if that were to take place, it'd be Jewish people saying, we want to restart some sort of temple. And yeah, and I think that if that is the case, it fits perfectly with what's being said here. And Antichrist would be perhaps given him permission to do that. Yeah, stranger things have happened. You know, sometimes we read these things and we think, oh, that's just too weird. That's just too weird. I mean, could that really be? And we get all skeptical about it. But if we'd have been meeting 100 years ago, okay, no, say 150 years ago. If we'd have been meeting 150 years ago and anybody said Israel would be a world power with jets flying up and down in the Middle East and a threat to all of their neighbors militarily, they would have laughed you to scorn 150 years ago. It was nothing but a desert. There was nothing like that. So don't, you know, things can happen. And they may not, sometimes we get really, really super literal about various things. What I encourage is that you leave a little bit of wobble room, but look for the basic material outline of what's supposed to take place and realize it's not too weird to happen. Nothing's too weird to happen. If you've been around long enough in this world, lots of weird stuff happens all the time. So, okay, so this is the 7-year, oh, Ginny? The sacrifices stopped in 70 AD with the destruction of the temple. The Pharisees, say that again? Well, when Jesus came, he told them, I'm it, and you're not getting another one. And they said, we're going to kill you anyway. And he said, within one generation, this entire thing will be, the cursing of the fig tree, this entire thing will be done. And it was done, and that was it. There is no more sacrifice for sins. The Pharisees, including the Apostle Paul, continued, however, even as Christians, to go to the temple, and they worked the Old Testament sacrificial system even after Jesus had finished everything, and they were doing it in memoriam to him, doing it as, because they didn't see it coming down yet, but then once it was completely destroyed, within 40 years of Jesus saying those things, then there was never any more sacrifices after that. And Paul got in trouble, by the way, for telling the Gentile Christians they didn't have to go to the temple and do that. You remember that? But the Jewish Christians at the time were free to continue doing it because the temple was still there. So there's this little overlap in which they were free to live, in a sense, in both covenants, you might say, even though they, as Christians they were in the new covenant. But they were free to go ahead and make the sacrifices because it was only going to be a little while until they couldn't do it anymore anyway. And they did do that. Paul went. He made sacrifices himself. You know, the question is, how do the Jews today explain that? You mean explain the need for forgiveness and atonement when there's no temple and no sacrifice? They certainly don't accept Christ. Judaism, of course, doesn't accept Christ. But from what I've read of what they say, they will say Judaism functions by being loyal to the Torah. The really conservative folks, what they'll say is, the Lord views our desire to obey Torah as equivalent to making sacrifices if we could, if we had the, you know. And so from what I've read, that seems to be how they deal with it. No, they would say because the temple is destroyed. If you ask the Jewish people at the time or even now, why do you not do sacrifices? I mean, aside from the liberal Jewish wings, but I mean, if you went to the conservatives who take the scriptures very seriously and so on, they would say we would do sacrifices if we had a temple. But we don't, so the Lord knows that, so he's given us the Torah, and we can obey the Torah, and he sees that as loyalty to him, and we're trusting that that's sufficient. It is a great coincidence that Jesus said these things would take place, and then they did, and, you know, that's a great coincidence that God sort of let his temple go into nothingness in light of the fact that Jesus had been there and so on, but nevertheless, that's the way it is. Genesis 15, yes. Oh, okay. Well, now you're mixing in a little good Christian theology into the Jewish way of viewing things. You're absolutely right. Joe makes the comment from Genesis 15 that when God made the covenant with Abraham, only God went through between the animals. You guys all familiar with Genesis 15? Do you know what that's saying there? Does everybody understand what that's saying? And Joe's pointing it out. God himself fulfills the covenant, and that's absolutely true. However, where does God fulfill the covenant? At the cross of Christ. And that's where the Jews would part company. They would not believe that. Yes. Yes, you're right. And this, of course, is the big problem. And this is why in Peter, you know, when Peter says, you know, people say, oh, everything's been the way it always has been and so on and so forth. And his answer to that is, yeah, you just don't know how long God's going to take. He says, I want you to live as though it can happen anytime. And that subject, Joe, brings us back to our topic. Imminence becomes a very important thing. It is true that the Lord says, I'll be back, and it appeared at the door. I mean, in James chapter 5, the Lord is at the door. He's there. He's right, you know, almost. And yet Jesus said very clearly in the Olivet Discourse, he said, I want you to keep oil in your lamp. Keep it burning. And I want you guys to be aware constantly that I'm going to take longer than you thought, but I want you also to be aware I could come anytime. And so you have this tension. You really do have this tension that you've brought up, Joe. And it is in this tension that the discussion about the rapture happens, because some people emphasize the length of time it takes, and some people emphasize the quickness and the imminency of it. And when you get into the arguments, usually you will find that they'll be motivated by an emphasis on one or the other of those two issues. So, okay, now, point being here. One more question? Oh, absolutely. The question is in Daniel 9:24, where it says what's going to happen by the time this whole thing is finished. It looks like very much what Jesus did. That's a great observation. It is exactly what Jesus did. He finished the transgression. He brings an end to these things. But however, he doesn't completely seal up vision and prophecy, does he? There's still visions, there's still prophecy, even after the day of Pentecost. But the beginning of this was finished by Jesus at the cross. And this becomes very, very important. I'm so glad you brought that up. Because when you look at what happens here and how the Lord says, this is what's going to take place, there is this blurring. Now, we look back on that and we say, well, some of these things were accomplished at the cross, and yet there's some things that aren't quite finished yet from Daniel 9:24. What this is the Old Testament people looking forward to what's going to happen and seeing the overall picture, but not being close enough to see that there's a period of time that transpires in between certain things. It's like looking at a mountain range and you see, and it looks like one mountain range, okay? Oh, when I get over that mountain range, then I'll be where I'm going to go. Then you get up closer to it and you climb up the first mountain and you realize, oh my stars, this thing keeps going and going. And from a great distance back, it didn't look like that. But when you get closer to it, there's several things that take place and there's valleys in between. There are these gaps of time in between. Now, when the people read this back here in Daniel 9:24, they're thinking this is all going to happen and probably in a very short period of time once it starts. Now we realize, yes and no. Now, I want you to grab that thought for a minute. See, the Jews knew all of this by heart, and they still missed Jesus completely. You have to remember, you have to be humble and careful about what you think about the future. Because the reason the Jews missed Jesus Christ when he came was that they had canonized their opinions about what he was going to look like and what he was going to do, and didn't realize that there were some time elements in here that God didn't tell them about. Had they been looking for the character of the Messiah, had they been looking for the fulfillment of the promises of the servant of Yahweh that you find in the Old Testament, Jesus filled all of those, but they weren't. What they had done is politicized and sort of fantasized themselves about what Messiah was going to look like. And when Jesus didn't meet their idea of what he ought to look like, that's why they missed it. Now, bear in mind, I was just reading another author in preparation for this, and he pointed this out, and I think it's a great insight. We don't know that much more about the second coming than the Jews knew about the first coming. And they were very confident and very mistaken about several things. And one thing's for sure about the Pharisees, they were the ones who called for the death of Jesus, and they were the most biblical people on the planet at the time. I hope that's not too insulting, because most of us would consider ourselves biblical and consider that to be a very good thing, and I agree. But part of being biblical is being humble, because the Bible teaches us that we don't know everything. And they forgot that, and we need to not forget that. Because when the Lord comes back, he's liable to surprise us. And I don't mean just in the timing. Okay? So bearing that in mind as we look into the discussion, that's why I'm actually doing this discussion the way I am. That's why I started with a post-trib thing, because I wanted y'all to hear that there are good people who disagree on the subject. And you can be confident and humble at the same time, and that's what we need to be. So I'm glad that you brought that up about verse 24 of Daniel 9, because it is fulfilled in Christ, but over a period of time. And the Christ event, the entire work of Christ, can be seen in the beginning, in his cross and resurrection, and at the end. And if you stand back far enough from it, you see the entire Christ event as one event, really. You can blend them together. And bear that in mind, that God bends time that way when he writes it down. Typically, we interpret the Old Testament through the New Testament truth. Yes, we do. That's what we're supposed to do. What Lee is pointing out is, and it's a very good point as well, what you want to do is always interpret everything through who Jesus is and what the New Testament says, rather than going back to the Old Testament and saying, well, if this is what it says in Daniel, then this is what it has to be in the New. And that's a very good point. It's a very fine point, because at times it's not easy to do that, because they interact with each other. See, Jesus is fulfilling this prophecy from Daniel, but this is a very real warning to all of us when we do this kind of work. And that is, it's easy to shift the emphasis off of the cross and off of Christ and start talking about prophecy based on Old Testament prophetic prophecies. And though they are true, if you focus on those to the exclusion of Jesus and the cross, if you don't keep it Christ-centered, not only can you get the prophecies themselves mixed up, but your application's completely wrong. So it is important, Lee, that's a good point. It is important that we start with who Jesus is, and if he says this is the way to interpret this, then we do it that way, no matter whether we see it clearly in Daniel or not. That's a principle of interpretation that's crucial. And when you do that, it does actually start to come clear. Now, back to the 7 years. This 7-year period of time is what there's a lot of argument about. Not just people who say, well, I think it all happened in history, but people who debate what's going to happen in those 7 years. So we'll move on. Just note that that's the case. Now, this is also in conjunction with the second coming of Christ, part of the day of the Lord issues. So tribulation, second coming of Christ, and also in context of Revelation 6 to 19, which we're going to talk more about tonight. Chapters 6 through 19 of Revelation are the action chapters, sort of Revelation. It's where the judgments are all carried on. And so there's a connection. Connect the dots between Daniel's 70th week, the tribulation period, the second coming of Christ, and Revelation 6 through 19. It is in the context of connecting those dots that all the people have their discussions about what takes place with regard to the rapture. And we'll see a little more about how it works. So most people also agree, as I mentioned last week, on two things: that the Bible you should take literally as possible, which means there's an old saying, if the literal sense makes good sense, seek no other sense. And that's really true. If what you're reading makes sense the way it is, then leave it alone and don't try and spiritualize it. And also, the millennium becomes very important. B under Roman numeral 4 on your notes. The millennium itself becomes important, because everybody that has this discussion discusses it from the standpoint of believing that Jesus will come back and start the millennium, and that millennium will be a literal reign on earth. Now, some of them will debate if it's really just 1,000 years or a long period of time, but they all believe that he will reign on the earth, and that becomes crucial, okay? Now, the post-tribulation argument, remember I gave you 10 reasons for the post-tribulation, why a lot of people believe that Christians will actually go through that 7-year period, and the post-trib view views the 7 years as all tribulation one way or another. Even though the terms are used a little bit flexibly, and sometimes you have to ask a person to define their terms, generally speaking, this means at the end of the 7-year period, when the Lord returns, after the tribulation of those days, said Jesus, when the Lord returns, that's when he rescues the church. And I gave you 10 reasons for it. The first was, there's no two-stage event in the New Testament. It isn't portrayed as two stages. It is portrayed as one stage, and we looked at this. Secondly, none of the passages that describe the rapture clearly indicate its chronological relationship with the second coming. That's true, but in Thessalonians and Corinthians, the passages do associate it with the second coming, and that is always referred to at the end of the tribulation. Do you guys follow with me? Because I'm going real fast through this because I want to get into the other one and a couple of the others that go with it. The Olivet Discourse places elect people in the tribulation period. Bear that in mind. The Olivet Discourse talks about the elect. And we, a lot of times, as pre-trib folks, have been taught that elect means Israel. But when you look at the word elect in the New Testament, it refers to the church. So you can actually build that case. 2 Thessalonians 2 fits better with the post-trib position. If the rapture, the day of the Lord, and the second coming are one unified event, it made simple sense in 2 Thessalonians. In Revelation number 5, Revelation 6 to 19 mentions saved people on earth during the tribulation. And it does. We know there are people who are saved during that time. And even though the word church isn't used, a pre-tribber will say the term church isn't used, therefore the church isn't there. What would a post-tribber say to that? The term church isn't used, therefore the church isn't there. What is that called in argumentation? That's called an argument from silence. Do you know what an argument from silence is? It means, it says, because that's not mentioned, therefore it can't be there. Is that true? If somebody comes and they say to me, was so-and-so in church on Wednesday night? And I say, I didn't see them. Is that the same as saying they weren't there? Okay, so an argument from silence isn't exactly a strong argument. And the post-tribbers will point this out. We'll talk more about that. Revelation 3:10, which says that he will preserve the Philadelphia church in Revelation 3:10 from the hour. The post-trib folks will point out that that actually doesn't prove the pre-trib rapture, and I mentioned it last week, and they have a case. Number 7, it is true that the Lord will protect his people from his wrath. All sides agree on this in light of those two passages, but the great persecutions and overpowering of the saints are not God's wrath, they're Antichrist's wrath. Now bear that in mind. One of the strong arguments for post-trib rapture is that most of what's going on, especially in the first half and maybe even the first two-thirds or three-quarters of that seven-year period, if that's all tribulation, much of it is Antichrist fighting God's people, not God fighting God's people. And so they would say, well, the wrath of God, that's not the wrath of God. The wrath of God doesn't start, you know, until the mid part or even further in some positions. They would say the wrath of God starts later. And it's actually a fairly good one. Also, 7 on your notes, B, it is possible for the Lord to protect his people from his wrath while leaving them on the earth during the period. Well, of course, and just like Israel in Egypt, he protected Israel in Egypt from the 10 plagues. And people will use that as the illustration. To which then people will say, oh yeah, that's right, but he also took Lot out of Sodom. And that's the illustration of that. And Noah out, you know, I mean, he saved Noah miraculously and killed everybody else and so on. So the bottom line is you can find illustrations of both ways that God protects people. He sometimes will pull them out, and he'll sometimes leave them in and protect them anyway. And that is important to understand. Number 8, the resurrection of the righteous in Revelation 20, verse 4 would seem to include all the saints up to that time. I know I'm going kind of fast. But this takes place at the end of the tribulation. And that, too, is a fairly strong argument, because the pre-trib view of that is that turn to Revelation 20, and I'll show you. I know I'm going very fast over these. The reason is because we really went into them last week. But in Revelation 20, it talks about a resurrection at the end of the tribulation. I saw the thrones, in verse 4, Revelation 20, verse 4, and they who sat on them, and judgment was given to them, and I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded because of the testimony of Jesus and because of the word of God, and those who had not worshipped the beast or his image, and they had not received the mark on their forehead and upon their hand, and they came to life and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. Now, the rest of the dead did not come to life until the 1,000 years were completed. So this, what he was just talking about, end of verse 5, is called the first resurrection. Blessed and holy is the one who has a part in this first resurrection. Over these, the second death has no power. Now, we'll talk more about this. We get into it in Revelation. But if he means the first resurrection here, a post-trib person would say, look, there's only one. That's one resurrection. You connect that with 1 Thessalonians 4. You have a resurrection of those that have fallen asleep in Jesus. You have the transformation of the people who are living there. It all happens at once. When does it happen? At the end of the tribulation. That seems to make sense. And the pre-trib answer is, it's one of those multifaceted things. A resurrection that would include the resurrection of all the saints prior to that. So it would include resurrecting all the Old Testament saints, resurrecting all the raptured saints, and that the answer would be, he's including all of those in the first resurrection. And there's actually several of them if you work through them. There's four. There's a resurrection of Jesus. There's the rapture. There's the Old Testament and tribulation saints from Daniel 12. And then there's the millennial saints. So there's four, actually. And so the answer would be, it's not quite as clear as just one resurrection, is it? What about Jesus? He definitely was resurrected prior to. And what about the other people in Matthew 27? When Jesus, you remember in Matthew 27, when Jesus came back from the dead, the temple curtain was rent and people popped out of their graves and they were walking around. That bothers a lot of people. What was going on? What kind of resurrection is that? Is it possible that resurrection has phases to it and all would be considered the first resurrection? Now you see, so when you begin to look at them, it's not quite as simple, but the post-trib argument is, yes, it is simple, and it all happens right then, okay? Number 8, imminency of Christ's return does not require an instantaneous or any moment view of things. In other words, you could say something is imminent, but it wouldn't have to be instant. It could be imminent, like it happened over a short period of time and still surprise everybody. And that, to me, is a little bit of equivocation with regard to what imminent means, but that's how they would answer it. That's how they would view it. Imminency doesn't require instantaneous, any moment kind of view of things. And then finally, the early church, and we'll get back to this, but number 10 of those arguments is that the early church held essentially a post-tribulation view of things. They did believe for the first 300 years, if you remember, that Jesus would come back and set up a 1,000-year reign. This is demonstrable from the writings of the first 300 years. You can see that's what they believed. They were not amillennial. They were premillennial. They believed Jesus would come back and then set up his millennium. And they believed in a very literal millennium. But they appeared to also say that they expected to go through whatever the tribulation period was. And you could tell this in what they're writing. And so one of the post-trib arguments is the early church was post-trib. Have you heard that argument? I mean, other than here, when you discuss this with people, have you ever heard people say that? No? Okay, well, you have now. Okay, now, so those are the 10 reasons why folks will hold a post-trib view. Now let's talk about the pre-trib view. The Lord will appear, here's the definition of it, the Lord will appear to rescue his church just before the tribulation period. Now remember, bear in mind, this is assuming that 70th week of Daniel is the tribulation period. That's the assumption. There is a 7-year period, the quote, tribulation, between the rapture and the second coming. The church will return with him at the second coming. So he comes back in chapter 19 of Revelation with his armies and they're clothed in white. Notice they don't do any fighting. He handles everything, but they come with him. Pre-tribulationists hold their view for the following reasons. Now, let me point some out before we even look at these. And you can jot this down wherever you want. But what this is saying, in other words, is that though they may be in some ways connected, the rapture and the second coming are two separate events. That's real essential to the pre-trib view. They view the rapture and the second coming as two separate events, even though from a distance they would look like one. When you get closer to them, remember what I said about the mountains, pre-trib view would be, even though they look like they're one and you can call them the coming of the Lord or whatever, they're really two different events. One is him coming and getting his people, the other is him coming and dealing with his enemies. Very different. Post-trib sees them as one, essentially one event entirely. The interesting thing is that even in post-tribulationalism and in the pre-wrath view, there still is at least a short period of time between one and the other. They don't happen simultaneously. Even in the post-trib view, they don't happen simultaneously. They happen within some varying degrees, but sometimes a few days, sometimes a few hours, depends on who's theorizing about it, but they're still a separate event. So bear that in mind, and that's very important to the pre-trib view. Also, jot this down. In this view, the tribulation equals the day of the Lord, which equals the 70th week of Daniel, which equals the wrath of God. Okay, write that down. The tribulation equals the day of the Lord, which equals the 70th week of Daniel, which we just looked at, the 7 years. These are all talking about the same thing. In this view, these are all talking about the same thing. Tribulation equals the day of the Lord, the 70th week, and the wrath of God. And I gave you a worksheet on the day of the Lord. Did everybody get one? The day of the Lord and about the rapture. These are fairly important little things. The concept of the day of the Lord becomes really important. And in the pre-tribulation view of things, the day of the Lord has to be equated with the full 7 year period. If it's not equated with the full 7 year period, then it's hard to make a case for the pre-tribulation rapture, and I'll show you why as we go through it. And that's why these arguments get kind of technical. Okay, we're going to dive in. The day of the Lord is a semi-technical term in the Old Testament used to refer to the Lord's direct intervention, usually in judgment against his enemies. It's used 18 times, and I'm just going to race through this. It's used 18 times, three times in the New Testament, and it's also referred to as, quote, the day. And you can see these. It's against Babylon, against Egypt, against apostate Israel in Joel and Zephaniah both, against the world before the Lord's return. The whole world, it becomes a part of it. So the concept of the day of the Lord coming in judgment, very clearly seen in the Old Testament, and the phrase is a semi-technical phrase. The day of the Lord means a period of time in which God judges. And there's this always this sense of the great day of the Lord that's eventually going to come. Okay? That's the one that's being spoken of in 1 Thessalonians 5 and 2 Thessalonians 2, and also in 2 Peter 3. Now, there's five observations. Bear in mind, these things go together if you're building a pre-trib argument. It's more than 24 hours. It's not just one day. It's more than 24 hours. It's a long period of time, as a matter of fact. Secondly, it's a period of unprecedented divine wrath against an unbelieving world. You see this in 2 Peter. So the day of the Lord is a long period of time, or at least more than 24 hours, and it's unprecedented, and it is wrathful. The phrase, the day of the Lord, refers to God pouring out wrath. Now, some people argue about that, and they'll say, well, no, it doesn't. But look it up, you'll find. It does. It talks about him judging his enemies almost invariably. In fact, invariably. It's always got something to do with that. C, a period of purging Israel of unbelief and rebellion. And you can see these quite clearly in the passages that I laid out. These are Old Testament references. Now, why is Israel important again? Because in Daniel's prophecy, it says Israel has something to do with what God is doing. God, in the development of the redemptive process, is using the nation of Israel. So if the day of the Lord has something to do with purging Israel of its sins, then that's going to have an impact on how we view the day of the Lord at the end of time. It might have something to do with Israel. And that contributes significantly to the pre-trib rapture. And I'll show you why. See that Israel's important. Purging Israel of unbelief. D, it's a period culminating in the second coming and preparing for the millennium. The day of the Lord culminates in the second coming and preparing for the millennium. Tribulation, they are equated, but remember that the tribulation period ends and then the Lord comes. He says immediately after the tribulation of those days. Yeah? Everybody follow me? The word day of the Lord, the phrase day of the Lord, actually extends a little beyond that. It includes that. And you could say, for general purposes, it is that seven-year period. But it also would include going a little beyond and the Lord setting up and preparing his kingdom, because he becomes the real ruler of the earth from then on. So you have tribulation, which is our experience, or the experience of the earth at the time, and the day of the Lord being equated. But then the concept of the day of the Lord carries on beyond the tribulation a little bit. Okay? Nevertheless, for general purposes, they would be equated, and it's important in the pre-trib rapture to see the day of the Lord being the wrath of God and really extending for the full 7 years. Can anybody tell me why? Why is that important logically? Why is it important logically that the day of the Lord be viewed as the 7 years if you're a pre-tribber? There has to be a time gap. There has to be time that takes place. What else? Why? What in the Bible? Remember, all of us are saying we believe the Bible, everybody in the discussion. What is there in the Bible that would make you want to connect the day of the Lord with the full 7 year tribulation if you're a pre-tribber? What does it say about enduring the wrath of God? It says the church will not endure the wrath of God. If you can show that the day of the Lord is the same as the 7 year tribulation, and that it is the wrath of God, you can build a case for the church not being there. Does that make sense? Based on the idea that the church will not undergo the wrath of God. Do you see? You got that? So that's why in the pre-trib rapture view, in the, as you build the view and as you look at it and you see how it developed over the last 150 years, this connection between the day of the Lord being the wrath of God and being equated with the 70th week of Daniel, that 7 year period, that you got to connect those dots, because that helps you build the idea that, well, if that really is the wrath of God and we've been told that we're going to be delivered from the wrath of God, maybe he will get us out of there before that happens. So that's how the logic works. Susie asked, if it says that he comes after the tribulation, how do you work that in? The coming after the tribulation, according to a pre-tribber, would be that he comes back and judges his enemies, but he's already rescued the church before he comes back. Remember, they're two different events. In the pre-trib view, the rapture happens and then the second coming, where it says in Matthew 24 that he comes back after the tribulation of those days. No problem. That's just him returning and judging his enemies. No, they would put the Battle of Armageddon. She said, wouldn't it be three comings because the Battle of Armageddon. No, the Battle of Armageddon in that scheme would be at the very end and would be equated with the second coming. In fact, pretty much everybody says that. The Battle of Armageddon, everybody except the pre-wrath view. The Battle of Armageddon probably is the moment at which the Lord comes and returns and puts his foot on the Mount of Olives, Zechariah chapter 12 through 14, and all of the destruction and so on. So there's only two, there would be only two comings in the sense of one coming to get the church and the other coming to judge the church in the pre-trib view, not three. And there would be no problem with him coming after the tribulation of those days, because that would mean that he was just coming to judge his enemies. Now, a post-tribber would say, well, what's wrong with seeing him coming and rescuing us too after the tribulation of those days? And that's why this is not such an easy argument, you see. A lot of why people believe what they believe is because they believed other things first. And there's these other presuppositions that we bring to the argument, you see. And we go, well, if this is true and this is true, then this is probably true. And that's what I call a cantilevered doctrine. Anybody have a cantilevered deck? That means a deck that doesn't have a post that goes all the way down and holds it up. So you better hope the engineer really built it right. A lot of these doctrines are cantilevered. They don't have a post that goes down to a verse in the Bible. But they may have been engineered pretty well. You know, you see what I'm saying? Is that making sense using that metaphor with the engineering? Because the theological presuppositions are really what this whole discussion is about, which is why we can't be too dogmatic about some of it. The theological presupposition that the tribulation is 7 years, and it is the 70th week, and that that is the same as the day of the Lord, which is almost certainly the wrath of God being poured out, helps build the case for the idea that if the church is not supposed to endure the wrath of God, then they might be out of there during that time. And that's how the logic started to develop in the early 1800s when this thought began to come up. Randy, did you say something? If you're post-trib, the day of the Lord is after Armageddon. Yes, yes. That's right. The post-tribbers would not have a gap in time between, yes, between the rapture and the second coming. Another hand back there, Steve? The question that Steve's bringing up is, when I refer to the church not enduring the wrath of God, am I referring to the fact that Jesus endured it for us? Theologically, yes. Existentially, yes. Biblically, I'm referring to very specific statements, 1 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 10. 1 Thessalonians, where are those? There are several of them. I had them written down. Just Google wrath, and you'll see them. Everybody agrees on this, by the way. In this entire discussion, nobody thinks that the church is going to endure the wrath of God. Does everybody understand that here that we're talking now? Nobody, post, pre, mid, pan, whatever you want, none of them believe that the church is going to endure the wrath of God. The only question is, how is the Lord going to deliver the church? Is he going to deliver them through it, like Israel from the plagues of Egypt, or is he going to deliver them from it, like Lot from Sodom and Gomorrah? Those are the two questions. And the people who believe he's going to deliver them through it are the post-tribbers, and everybody else is a version of pre-trib. Everybody else is a version of the Lord getting them out of there just before he pours out his wrath. Does that make sense? Everybody got that so far? Okay, Chuck. Chuck wants to know if I'm going to cover the mid-trib and the pre-wrath view. I will talk about them very briefly and maybe answer a couple of questions, but I'm not going to get... You want to talk about cantilever doctrines. A couple of the doctrines involved in some of these smaller views are very cantilevered. They're way out there. They depend on two or three assumptions exegetically that are not strong enough. I want to see... In here, I want us to get this. I want us to get hold of this. All the views on the subject boil down to versions of these two, bottom line. All the views on the subject boil down to either God's going to keep us through it, post-trib, or God's going to keep us from it, pre-trib, mid-trib, which is still you're being delivered from the wrath of God in the second half, or pre-wrath, in which it's almost identical to the post-trib, except they don't see the wrath coming till the very, 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 very end. But you're still out of there when the wrath comes. And so there's two basic divisions. There's the through it and the from it views, okay? And the most famous from it view is pre-tribulationalism, that you get out 7 years before the second coming. Chuck? So you're forcing me to talk about what I said I wasn't going to talk about anyway, yes? And what you're articulating, Chuck, is the mid-trib thing. And Gleason Archer has done some really good work on that, and it's exactly what you're saying. And there's a great, it could be, because from the mid part of the tribulation, the abomination of desolation, then you could see the trumpet judgments and the bowl judgments, and that's why Gleason Archer and others clear back into the mid-1940s have speculated, well, maybe it's the middle of that week instead of at the very beginning of the week. Let me press through the rest of the pre-trib arguments, and then we'll come back and catch a couple of those other ones. But does everybody understand that there's really only essentially two major views? And under the pre-tribulation or the pre-wrath views, and those are technical terms, but I'm using them non-technically, among the views that say God's going to get us out and not just carry us through, we've got three or four variations on a theme and lots of different ideas about how he's and when he's going to get us out. But I want you to get it. He's either going to carry us through or get us out. Pre-trib is get us out. Post-trib is carry us through. Okay? Yes, post-trib would say that the rapture occurs right at the time when the Lord returns to judge his enemies. It's the same exact event. Well, and that's what the post-tribbers say to the pre-tribbers, and the pre-tribbers said to the these three tribbers came into a bar, and one of them said, yeah, that's what they say to each other, is it doesn't make sense to me why he would take us out and then bring us back, and then the pre-tribbers would say, well, it doesn't make sense to me that he would take us up and bring us right back. I mean, it's like, boom, boom, I'm going to get whiplash, you know? Okay, so this is, and a lot of it is not so much what makes sense to us, is what, how we do the exegesis, which, if you'll let me finish, we'll press through. Let's move through the basic argument. Now, many of you know this argument. Here's how it goes, and I'm starting, I think, with the strongest ones. The pre-trib view of things, which is that the Lord comes back in the beginning of the of the last 7 years, makes the best sense of the promise to be protected from his wrath, 1 Thessalonians 1:10 and 5:9, to be protected from his wrath. I mean, that would definitely do it. If you're going to say, I want to be protected from his wrath, and you can prove or even demonstrate that it's probable that he's going to get you out of there before Daniel's 70th week happens, then that definitely fits the bill. And that's a strong argument. I mean, if you really are looking for God protecting you from his wrath, the pre-trib argument is strong on that. There is good reason to see the entire 7 years or the entire trib period as the pouring out of God's wrath on the whole world. And the good reason is, if you connect, here again, you see, the assumption is that Revelation chapter 6 and the sealed judgments are part of the tribulation and part of the wrath of God. And in that seal, those seals are unsealed, and the scroll that the Lamb, Christ, is popping the seals off of is the history of the end. That's what's in that scroll. From the very first one, it's the authority of God and the Lamb that opens those seals. Boom, boom, boom. And the angel said, come, and the four horsemen of the apocalypse are all coming. And that's the first seal. So what the pre-tribbers will say is, there's no indicator that this is not the wrath of God. Why? Because God's the one doing it. And even the Antichrist himself is being allowed by God. And people say, well, no, the Antichrist is the Antichrist, and God is God, and God doesn't have anything to do with what the Antichrist is doing. Really? I don't know that you want to really push that. I don't think you want to say God's got his hands tied behind his back and can't do anything until Antichrist is done. I think you have, you know, the pre-tribbers would say, there's a good reason to see the entire chapter 6 through 19 as the wrath of God being poured out. And that's one of their arguments, okay? By the way, the pre-trib view never was understood to be protection from small t tribulation, but protection from God's wrath. Please note that, because the caricature of the pre-trib view is that it's escapist. Do you understand what I mean by that? When people caricature the pre-trib, and post-tribbers will say, ah, you pre-tribs, you just want to get out of here and leave all your debts for the pagans. Maybe there are people, did I hear an amen to that? I suppose there are people who would say that. But you know, you got to understand that Jesus said you're going to have tribulation. He did not promise us an easy life. And I think there probably are folks who seriously have thought that's what the pre-trib rapture meant, is that I get to buy a new SUV every year, and I get to live in a newer house every you know, 6 years, and I get a really cush retirement, and then boy, then I get to go to heaven. How, it just doesn't get better than that. That is not what the pre-trib rapture ever meant. It's not what it means now. All it means is you're not under the wrath of God. It doesn't mean you won't have a hard life. It doesn't mean you won't endure tribulation in the world. Okay? So that escapist accusation against the pre-trib thing is really not a valid accusation. And you'll hear it sometimes. But it's not really valid. Even though I think there are people probably who hold it, it's not the way it was supposed to be formulated. Secondly, okay, this view makes the best sense of Revelation 3:10. In Revelation 3:10, you can turn there if you have Revelation open and see what it says. It says, to the Philadelphia church, that you will be preserved from the hour of testing that's going to come upon the whole world. And that actually is a pretty clear, it's the Philadelphia church, because you have kept this word of my perseverance, I also will keep you from the hour of testing, that hour which is about to come upon the whole world to test those who dwell upon the earth. The point being that God is saying, at least to that church, that they will be delivered from something. And if you interpret these letters to the churches as being applicable throughout the church age, then you can make a strong case for that. It does make the best sense of that. And we talked about this last week. The Greek little preposition ek really usually does mean come out of. And so that's how a pre-tribber would view it. They'd say, I think it's best to see the Lord pulling us out. Number three, it allows for believers in old model bodies to inhabit and populate the millennium. To inhabit and populate the millennium. A believer in an old model body, that's the kind you have. You have a Model A body. And you have resurrection life, new age life, in an old body as a Christian from the moment you come to Christ. Now, at the end of the tribulation, when the Lord sets up the millennium, when you look at the passages, which I gave you there in the notes, what you find is people going into that period of time, and they're in old model bodies. It allows the pre-trib rapture or some sort of rapture that happens sometime prior to the end of the tribulation. Pre, mid, even pre-wrath almost would make it, although the pre-wrath ones are almost right at the very end. But nevertheless, it would leave some room for people to come to the Lord and be loyal to Him at the very end and not be raptured up. Does everybody understand what the problem is? If you're going to populate the millennium, which it appears is going to happen, and there are people with old model bodies, where are you going to get them? Because if He destroys His enemies and raptures His friends, who's left? Nobody in an old model body. Does that make sense? Now, it's true there's no verse that says, therefore, this has to be pre-trib. But you can see where the pre-trib view says, well, this makes sense of that. This could actually leave room, because if it happens earlier, you've got many years for people to come to Christ, be loyal to the Lord, not get killed, and be alive when the Lord returns. And then the sheep and goat judgment in Matthew 25, where He says to the sheep, enter into the kingdom prepared for you. And He says to the goats, right? So, and all the goats are gone, and all the sheep come in, and there's sheep. There's some sheep. And the pre-trib folks would point out to the post-trib folks, there's not enough sheep left if they all get raptured at the same time the Lord returns. Yeah? Does that make sense? Okay. So that would be part of the argument. There are no goats in the tribulation. And by the way, I mean in the millennium. And by the way, I've read a couple of answers to that. And I got to admit, for my money, that's a pretty strong argument for the pre-trib deal. I haven't read a good convincing argument from the post-trib thing that cinches down how the sheep go into the millennium without getting raptured first. If all the righteous people are raptured, I have not seen a good argument against this. Number four, if it's pre-trib, it allows for an imminent return while still leaving room for many of the indicators that lead up to the second coming. Has anybody noticed that there's a lot of passages that say it can happen anytime, and then there's a lot of passages that say some stuff has to happen first? Well, one of the ways to solve that, and the pre-trib, classic pre-trib way, is that when the Lord comes to get us, that can happen anytime. And that still leaves a lot of time for other things to happen that are said to happen prior to the coming of the second coming. If you say, well, He's coming to get His church first, and then there's other things that are going to take place, that leaves room for an imminent return. And imminency becomes one of the strongest arguments for the pre-trib rapture, the idea that it can happen any time. Because if post-trib is right, it can't happen for at least 7 years. Unless you've met the Antichrist recently. You see what I'm saying? You see what I'm saying? So the imminency idea, now the pre-trib argument is this, the imminency idea fades from the scene if you don't see the rapture happening sometime prior to the second coming as a surprise. Because the Lord said, it'll be a surprise. So imminency becomes very important. And by the way, now some of you might be thinking, what about those poor folks in the first 300 years who were post-trib premillennial? It's a little bit awkward to try and put them into this scheme because they didn't have the vocabulary. They didn't have an argument since the 18. This argument only came up because of pre-tribulationalism in the early 1800s. This whole discussion only came up. The concept of post-trib was never even thought of in terms of calling it anything until someone said, maybe it's going to happen before the end. That's where the idea of pre-trib came from. So to look back into the first 300 years and say they were post-trib, even though I said it last week and I'm saying it because it is an argument used by post-trib folks, actually, that's a little bit of a misnomer. They actually thought they were in the tribulation. They thought the Lord's coming back, and there's a lot of writing about imminence too. They thought He was coming back anytime. They expected Him back anytime. And when you read all of what they wrote, they thought they were in some form of tribulation, and they had every reason to believe that, by the way. So they didn't have this discussion that we have. They would not have been saying, are you post-trib or pre-trib? Because the discussion never came up. Does that make sense? So the argument that the first 300 years were post-trib, that's not a particularly strong argument, because the first 300 years were also very imminent. Their writings were very strong on imminency. They believed the Lord would come back anytime. So it allows for an imminent return. Number five, it allows Israel to take center stage as the venue for gospel work. Now, the reason I had you go to Daniel chapter 9, verse 27, was to show you that that last 7 years has a Jewish flavor to it. Daniel was saying, what's going to happen to my people? And this is why pre-trib folks often say the word elect in Matthew 24 does refer to Israel. Because it can refer to Israel, even though it refers to the church mostly. It can refer to Israel under some circumstances, and they're saying, well, maybe it does in the Olivet Discourse. And that this is a particularly Jewish period of time in which the Lord says, I'm going to come back and deal with my people Israel after several thousand years of hardness in their hearts, which is what it says in Romans 11. When the fullness of the Gentiles has come in, the hardness of Israel's heart will be softened. Okay? So this allows Israel to take center stage in the venue of gospel work, which if you see that as an important issue, which I think it is, that points to the idea, well, then if the Lord took the church off and dealt with Israel again, that makes sense. None of these things will cinch it. None of these things will prove it beyond a shadow of a doubt. But I'm just showing you how the pre-trib folks, from the way they're viewing it, this gives Israel a chance to be center stage again, fulfilling the 70th week of Daniel. Number six, it explains why the rapture passages are different from the second coming passages. And there are some differences. When you read the passages, the rapture ones don't have any birth pangs that lead up to them. And the second coming ones do. But we already sort of dealt with that a little bit. But they are different. Number six, passages are different from the second coming ones. Number seven, there is no reason that a prophetic event might not be divided into two or more phases. And this is actually pretty clearly seen in the Old Testament too. One of the arguments against the pre-trib rapture is that there's no indicator that it's two phases. Okay, all right. I can, if you look at it that way, I can see, okay, there's no indicator there's two phases. But there's no indicator that it has to be one phase either in order to fulfill prophecy. There are many prophecies that are two-phase prophecies. And from a distance, they look like one. But when you get closer to them, there is a difference in time, and they could still be seen as the same event. The incarnation, the atonement, and the resurrection. The incarnation and the atonement were 33 years apart. And the atonement and the resurrection were 3 days apart. How tight do you want to get everything down? You know, from the Old Testament, it just looks, that's the Christ event. That's the Messiah. Well, you get closer to it, there's at least 33 years in between part of it. So there's no reason why there can't be phases in what takes place in the future. Now, the other positions, mid-tribulation rapture, basically, is similar to the pre-trib, not identical, but as Chuck pointed out, the mid-tribulation rapture basically says we're not going to endure the wrath of God. The wrath of God won't start till the middle of the tribulation with the abomination of desolation being set up. So a mid-trib person would be saying, I will see the Antichrist. A pre-trib person would say, I won't see the Antichrist. I'll be out of here before the Antichrist makes his pact with Israel. A mid-trib person would say, no, I'll see the Antichrist and I'll rack up my credit card for 3.5 years. Not really. But the logic still works because it says that we won't endure the wrath of God. If you can show the wrath of God starts in the middle part after the abomination of desolation, you can make that case. Gary? It says no one knows the hour or the day. That's correct. And that's where that and all the rest of those passages is what argues for imminence. That means it can happen anytime. Yeah, that's precisely the point. Yes. Ah, yes. One of the pre-trib arguments that you will hear that you will not hear from me is from 2 Thessalonians 2, where Paul says to the Thessalonians that there has to be a falling away, an apostasy, before the man and the man of sin be revealed before the day of the Lord. And some folks will say that falling away, the word apostasy, can be translated departure. And the problem is that I am absolutely not convinced, and I've looked at that word, and I've seen Dr. English's case where he says this can be translated this way. And it's built on classical Greek, not biblical Greek. and I don't believe that it's a strong case. The word apostasia means to, the way it's used in the Bible, it's only used one other time in the Bible, and that is falling away from Judaism in Acts. So apostasia was, in Koine Greek, it meant to fall away, and I think that's the best way to view it. So that I don't think is a strong argument for the preacher of rapture. I'm glad you brought it up, though, because it's one you hear from time to time. That 2 Thessalonians passage, I have a whole worksheet on it. If you're interested, email me, and I'll send you the worksheet on 2 Thessalonians. But I want to get through the rest. The pre-wrath rapture essentially is a post-trib pre-wrath idea. What it is it means the Lord getting us out of here, but he's getting us out of here just in the nick of time. We're here for the whole 7 years. We're here for the whole last 3.5 almost, and we're out of here just before the end. And because they view only the last section as the actual wrath of God being poured out. Okay, so that's why it's called pre-wrath. And again, not to beat it to death, but does everybody understand at least one thing? There's only two basic types. God will get us through it. God will take us out. Within the God will get us through it ones, it's the pre-trib, it's the post-trib deal. God will get us through it. And the all-male people, amillennialists, postmillennialists, everybody, God's going to get us through it. The God's going to get us out of it ones are the premillennial folks who believe in a pre-trib or mid-trib or pre-wrath, but at some point along the line, he's rescuing us from what he's doing on the earth, okay, and getting us out just in time. In all these cases, God is still faithful to his people. In all these cases, nobody thinks God is going to put his wrath on his own people. Does everybody understand that? And there's good folks on all sides. So, what to remember about the rapture? Number one, God is not taking a vote. Please take note. And that is my mantra these days. When people argue about this, I tell you, I just leave the room. And that's why I gave you that other sheet. Unity over unanimity. I want you to read what those scholars say about these issues. I want you to take it to heart. God is not taking a vote, no matter what position you hold. It's not going to alter what he's going to do, okay? And you can trust him no matter which position it is. And some people are very worried because their position doesn't seem to be, what if it's not true? Oh, if it's not true, God's not faithful to you. He's not going to take care of you like he said he would? You're going to all of a sudden find yourself under the wrath of God? No. He's not taking a vote on this. No matter which position you hold, it's not going to alter the reality. No matter which position you hold, it's not going to alter your response to this life that we live. You're supposed to be poised and ready all the time, no matter what position you hold. And everybody will say basically the same. All of them agree on that. B, salvation does not depend on understanding this. Does everybody get that too? You're not saved by understanding which positions the rapture positions are. This is way down the food chain of stuff. It should not show up on a doctrinal statement that you have to sign. You should not break fellowship with people over this. In any church, you should be allowed to hold whatever of these views you, everybody hopes it's pre-trib for heaven's sake. So everybody should be allowed to hold the position they want to hold within, and you're free in this church to hold whichever position you want. And then C, ministry does not depend. Oh, you don't have C. I added that, a little scribal embellishment in the text. But note this, ministry does not depend that we agree on this. Ministry does not depend on the fact that we agree. You can minister right alongside people that have a different view on this. And I'll tell you why. Is because the instructions from the Lord to serve him are based not on the rapture, they're based on the cross. The instructions for the Lord, the paradigm for understanding life in this age is not the rapture, it's the cross. And do you know what that means? That means you die for Jesus and you live for Jesus. That's the paradigm of the cross. And that's why it says in Revelation, to him who overcomes. Do you know what overcoming means in Revelation? In the book of Revelation, you know what overcoming means? It means dying rather than giving up your faith in Christ. That's what overcoming means in Revelation. Revelation 12:11, they did not love their lives even unto death. So you see, the paradigm for the Christian life is the cross, not the rapture. So we're free to disagree, and we're going to live loyally to the Lord no matter how he works this out. And we're going to say along with the early church, even so, Lord Jesus, come quickly. Heavenly Father, we pray that you would strengthen us with this wisdom, that you'd teach us and speak to our souls, because we want to be ready. We want to be poised and prepared. We want to be people who are living for you no matter what's going on in the world around us, living wisely and hoping, Lord, that you will come back soon, because that is the prayer of the church at all times. Until you return, may we be busy about the things of your kingdom, living powerful, loyal, grace-filled, God-saturated lives. In Jesus' name, amen.